You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And if it's true, as former President Obama said, that you can't understand America without understanding jazz, then by extension, you really can't understand America without understanding Louis Armstrong. He was the greatest jazz musician of the 20th century and a major influence on American culture and who we are today as a people. My guest today wrote a biography of Armstrong, and I'm thrilled to have him join me on the show. He's Terry Teachout. He's the drama critic of the Wall Street Journal and the critic at large of Commentary. He's written several books. What makes this book unique is that it's the only one written by somebody like Terry with a musical background, and he also had access to some new sources as well. So I'm really looking forward to this interview, especially as part of Black History Month. Terry, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. It's always good to talk about Louis.
And you just said my first question pertaining to his name. I grew up and everybody called him Louis. Let's just clear that up right now. It is Louis, right?
It is Louis. He himself didn't care what people called him. But if they asked, he would always tell them that he was not a Creole, and so you didn't pronounce it Louis, you pronounced it Louis. And if you listen to the opening of his famous record of Hello Dolly, he makes a point of singing, "This is Louis Dolly." And that was quite deliberate. He wanted the message to come through on that record.
So everybody out there calling him Louis, stop right now. You heard it from an authority here. Trace his upbringing in New Orleans. A very difficult upbringing, obviously, the times and all, but how he was able to overcome that and what first piqued his interest in music.
Well, he was essentially born in the gutter. He was born close to the Storyville section of New Orleans, what was then the red light district, the black red light district. There were two. And his mother had most likely done some prostitution herself. But the upside of this upbringing was that Storyville was not only a red light district, but it was a center of musical activity in New Orleans. It was just everywhere you looked. Even before he started playing cornet and then trumpet, he was actually singing on the streets of New Orleans. Had a kind of a barbershop quartet at one point. The big key, the great turning point, was one New Year's Eve. He took out his father's pistol and shot it off to celebrate New Year's Eve. He was arrested, and he was put in, not an orphanage, a home for children who had misbehaved. And this place had a band, and it also offered musical instruction. That was where he began to play cornet and was taught how to read music, something that many people don't know, that he was a very fluid sight reader. Played first chair in the band, and that was why he was able to move so quickly, because he had had, as a child, preparation, serious musical training. So when he got out, finally served his term, so to speak, he started playing everywhere he could, and he became the protege of Joe Oliver, who was known as King Oliver, who at that time was the top cornet man in New Orleans. When Oliver went north to Chicago to lead a band, he sent for Armstrong, who followed him there and was the second cornet man in King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, which is how he came to make his first records in 1923. And it was the first big step down the road to celebrity and musical importance.
I liked how you traced something I wasn't aware of, the role of riverboats in music history. And Louis Armstrong plied the riverboats where he actually met Bix Beiderbecke, who's from the local area here.
Yes, he did. I mean, that's the sort of story that sounds too good to be true, except that Armstrong himself remembered it. And one of the things that I learned from doing primary source research on Armstrong was that his memories of the past were accurate. He did not embroider them. He liked to tell a good story, and he turned them into set pieces. But when he says that he did so-and-so in such a year, it's almost certainly true in every detail. And sure enough, the riverboat stopped at Beiderbecke's hometown, and Bix, who was, I'm not sure how old he would have been, but he would have been either a boy or a just moving into puberty, heard him play there. And like everybody else who heard Armstrong in those early years, before his playing language had become part of the lingua franca of American music, before he was making records and making movies, when you first heard him, it was like a bolt from out of nowhere. You were just knocked flat. And although Beiderbecke did not play like Armstrong, he was incontestably influenced, shaped by Armstrong's concept of the solo. Louis Armstrong is one of the first jazz... He didn't invent jazz, always important to point that out. But he was one of the very first jazz musicians to step out from the ensemble of early New Orleans-style playing and be featured as a soloist in his own right. And that was the path that jazz itself would take. It became a solo-driven music because of Louis.
Like all good writing, you weave in, it's a tale of history, of music, of race relations, of a lot of different areas. And I was interested to see Al Capone's name pop up and Louis's association with the mob. That got him into trouble a little bit too.
It was a two-sided coin. Armstrong, the man who became his manager and the man who, so to speak, looked after him in adulthood, Joe Glazer, ran Capone's whorehouses. And Capone himself liked music, not just opera, but all kinds of music. And Armstrong, like everybody else, every musician I've ever heard about from Chicago who talked about Capone, said that he was a straight shooter when it came to how he treated the musicians who worked for him. He paid you on time, he looked after you, and he made sure you didn't get shot. So Armstrong had nothing but good things to say about Capone. But, of course, Capone was not the only factor in the mob. And at one point in his career, Armstrong got on the outs with another set of mobsters. And he actually ended up going to Europe for a while to get out of the crossfire, so to speak.
Yeah, tracing that trail from Chicago to New York to Harlem and then to Europe and then back. He's playing in a unique style in his performances as well. That I love the term you use, artistic populism, and which drew some criticism from folks in his era, but then some in later eras that kind of criticized his move kind of more in the entertaining instead of just being a musician.
Well, it's important to see Armstrong from his own point of view. I have never encountered him calling himself an artist or anything like that. He saw himself as an entertainer. I think that he knew what he was as a musician. You know, he didn't have any illusions about those great talents. He knew how great he was. But, you know, he saw himself as somebody who played for the people, who gave them what they wanted to hear, and colored it and infused it with his style and his personality. This is a very important thing when talking about Armstrong, is to understand that it is a personality that he became beloved very quickly. The big factor in that was when he started making movies. Bing Crosby, who was a jazz singer at the beginning of his own career and who was quite a passionate lover of jazz, made a point of getting Armstrong into his movies and making sure that he got billed, star billing above the title of the film. The first time was in a movie that Crosby made called Pennies from Heaven. And Hollywood discovered that Louis Armstrong was an incredibly photogenic person, that he just kind of leaped out of the screen, not just because of what he played or even his singing, but the whole personality, this great warm, expansive personality of his. You put him in front of a camera and the whole soundstage lit up. And it was those film appearances starting, I think, in 1935 that really made Armstrong a celebrity. It wasn't his records. The early jazz records were what is called race records. They were sold in the black community and to knowledgeable whites who were interested in jazz. But they were not popular successes. He did not become a popular figure in that sense until he started making film appearances. That was what turned the key in the door.
And you also discuss in the book how he started, that seemed to coincide a little bit with his popularity among white audiences, which I think might have played into some of the racial interpretation of how he performed in front of crowds as well.
I think there's something to that. We should explain what we're talking about here, which is that when Armstrong was in his earlier years, the fact that he saw himself as an entertainer, carried himself as one, was actually shaped to some extent by the minstrel shows he had seen in his youth. This didn't strike anybody as odd or inappropriate. It was only really after World War II, when jazz musicians like Dizzy Gillespie and later Miles Davis started to see themselves as artists. And they were quite uncomfortable with Armstrong's public image. He made them squirm. They thought he was, to use we now know is an ugly word that he hated when people said it about him. He was Tomming, behaving like an Uncle Tom. And he just didn't get that at all. He was just doing what he'd always been doing. And he was doing something that most black listeners thought was just as great as the white listeners did. But after the war, as the racial self-image of the black community began to shift, especially among younger people, there was a time when Armstrong was seen as an embarrassing figure, you know, as a holdover from the past. That finally went away, in particular because although Armstrong had never talked about politics, it was just not something that he did. He did speak out to a reporter because of the Little Rock school desegregation conflict in which President Eisenhower was slow to respond to the refusal of the governor of Arkansas to desegregate schools. Now, Armstrong, you know, I've just gone blank, but I think he may actually have been in Iowa on the road when this story broke, and a Cub reporter came to his hotel room and asked him about it. And Armstrong was a guy who, you asked him a question, he would answer it. And he spoke in a really astonishingly blunt way about Armstrong, about Orville Faubus, Eisenhower or Obama's, about the situation. And it made the front page of every newspaper in America. And suddenly, people who had thought that Armstrong was an old-fashioned, racially timid figure, suddenly they saw otherwise, that he was not that at all. There was never any other point in the future when he spoke out in this way. But this was enough to be on the front page of every newspaper. Because by then, Louis Armstrong was not just loved by jazz fans. He was one of the most beloved entertainment personalities in all of America. So when he spoke out, people listened.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Terry Teachout, who's the author of a book, biography, called Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong, where we've been talking about this book. And Terry, by the way, has Midwestern roots, born in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and attended the University of Illinois, Champaign. So it's always...
Grew up in Sykesville, a town down in the Boot Heel. And the town where I was born is a town on the Mississippi. Cape Girardeau was a town on the Mississippi.
Yeah.
And it is thought that one of Armstrong's riverboat gigs did actually play there. I think Jess Stacy, who was born in Cape Girardeau and who was Benny Goodman's great piano player, I think Stacy actually first saw him on a riverboat that paused in Cape Girardeau. So I have that connection, too, with the great Satchmo.
There's stories, since I've mentioned that I'd be interviewing you about Louis Armstrong, I've had more people say, well, I heard he played over in Burlington, Iowa. I heard he played here and there, and he probably did.
Almost certainly did. Like every other popular musician of that time, he spent his life on the road, on a bus. Only later did he ever fly to gigs. He spent at least two-thirds of his life as an adult out on the road, performing from coast to coast in every corner of America. He also performed in the Deep South and performed in front of segregated audiences until later in his career, which is one of the reasons why people like Gillespie and Davis were displeased with him. As his manager, Joe Glazer, said, look, you know, you go down there, you play for the Crackers, you take the money back with you, and you know, who's the jerk? Glazer was completely cynical about that, and Armstrong thought, sure, yeah. He'd play for anybody as long as they paid him.
We'll talk about the two songs that he's most associated with. Hello, Dolly, and What If a Wonderful World in a minute here. But what are you've written a lot in this book about some of his classic songs before then. What are some, share with our listeners some, if let's say there's people out there that know of Louis Armstrong some and would like to know more. What are some of the essential pieces you'd recommend they listen to?
Well, the great defining record is West End Blues, recorded in 1928 with a small group that also had Earl Hines on piano. This was a spectacular bravura example of Armstrong's virtuoso trumpet playing. He also sings a wordless vocal, a scat vocal in it. That's another one of his important contributions to jazz. From beginning to end, West End Blues is kind of like an Armstrong encyclopedia. Everything important about his trumpet playing went into it. Starting in the 30s, well, actually starting in 1929, he began performing with big bands. The first record he did that got any traction was Ain't Misbehavin', a vocal with a trumpet solo and a big band backing. The song written by and identified with Fats Waller. He actually performed that on Broadway as part of a show called Hot Chocolates. As he grew older, his playing became simpler and more straightforward in texture. And just a few years later, he recorded a version of Harold Arlen's I Got a Right to Sing the Blues that I myself think is the great recording of Armstrong's middle years as a big band soloist. He does a great vocal. And then does this incredible, it's so big and expansive, it's almost like it's operatic. The trumpet solo and the out chorus, it just makes your hair stand up. Whenever I give a talk about Armstrong, that's a record I always make a point of playing. Between them, those three records will give you an idea of what Armstrong was like before. Well, in 1947, Joe Blazer decided the big bands were going out. They were too expensive to run. So he got Armstrong to break up his big band that he'd been touring with for 10, 15 years. And he put together a small group called the All-Stars. And Armstrong toured with this group for the rest of his life. And in the beginning, it was very definitely an all-star band. It had Jack Teagarden on trombone, the Louis Armstrong of trombone, you might say, and Earl Hines, his old colleague, on piano. So that actually added years and years to his career because it was just simply a more manageable group to send around the country. That group probably was on the road even more than the big bands were. If you remember Armstrong, if you're old enough now to remember having seen Armstrong live, you almost certainly saw him with the All-Stars.
Then we come to the early 60s, which is when he performed Hello, Dolly, which really, I was really shocked how popular that song was at the time, supplanting some other rock and roll.
It knocked the Beatles off the top of the Billboard charts. That's popular.
Yeah.
And whenever Jerry Herman, of course, wrote Hello, Dolly, and whenever anybody asked him about the great moments in his career, he would always say that it was Armstrong who contributed as much as anybody to making Hello, Dolly a hit musical, because somebody brought Glazer the song, and you know, Armstrong, when Joe Glazer said record this, he always did. So he recorded Hello, Dolly before the show opened. And the record came out right around the time the show opened, 2-3 months later, by which time Armstrong is back on the road. And, of course, he doesn't even remember it. You know, I mean, he's a busy guy with a busy life. So he's out. Nobody knows exactly what city this happened in, but it did happen. There's lots of testimony to it. But Armstrong and the All-Stars have come out of the bandstand, and somebody yells at him, "Play that Hello, Dolly." And Armstrong leans over to the piano player and says, "I guess I'll clean this up." He says, "You know, what the hell are they talking about? What is this song?" He didn't remember it, and nobody in the band remembered it. Huh. So Joe Glazer sent them on an airplane a record of Hello, Dolly. They sat down in a hotel room, played it the next night, and it just knocked the roof off the club. And from then on, it became a must-play in his touring repertoire. And then he sang it. The record climbed the charts steadily, and it finally reached the point where I forget what the song the Beatles had on the charts. They had two or three different songs at the top of the charts that week. But Armstrong briefly took over the number one slot. It was the last time that a straight jazz record with a prominent solo topped the Billboard singles chart. And Armstrong was absolutely delighted and amazed, and it was for the rest of his life. He couldn't get off a stage without doing Hello, Dolly, and he was perfectly glad to oblige. He was a man who liked to please the people.
The other thing people react to me when I mentioned I was going to be talking to you about Louis Armstrong, unprompted, they would say, I'm going to have What a Wonderful World played at my funeral. I had two people say that, one a family member, one a good friend. And that song, he didn't...
I had it played at my wedding.
Yeah, it's just one of those songs that you still hear quite a bit. But what I didn't realize was that you pointed out was that he didn't even really live long enough to see that song soar in popularity.
No, it was brought to him by a record producer, and Armstrong was really struck by the imagery in the lyrics, which was in accord with his own philosophy of life, his own feelings about the beauty of the world he lived in. So he recorded it with a studio orchestra, not with his band. He does not play trumpet on this record. It wasn't initially a hit. It took a while for it to get traction. And I think it was a hit in England before it was a hit in the United States. But then people, whenever they heard it, they fell in love with it. And it was used in at least one film, Good Morning Vietnam. And Armstrong, again, this became one of the two songs that he had to perform wherever he went every night. And he sings it beautifully. It really, you can tell, I mean, everything he sang from the heart. But you can hear how this is really landing with him emotionally. I wrote a play, a one-person play about Armstrong, Satchmo at the Waldorf. And wherever we have produced it, we have used What a Wonderful World as out music at the end of the show.
Terry, we only have about a minute left. Just if you would, difficult as it may seem, sum up Louis Armstrong's impact on American culture for our listeners to wrap up today.
He brought jazz, real jazz, to a popular audience, and more specifically, culturally. He was very likely for a generation, maybe two generations of white Americans, the first black person to whom they responded with love and admiration. Those achievements, in a sense, are equal.
Terry Teachout has been our guest today on Heartland Politics. He's the author of Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong, which has been our topic today. He's also the drama critic of the Wall Street Journal. I encourage you to read his work. I do, and I really enjoy it. Terry, thank you so much for being our guest today.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.